The election of Joe Biden as the 46th president of the United States is a watershed moment for the nation and the world. News of Biden's victory has generally been met by many around the world, both allies and competitors alike, with a sense of anticipation and, in some cases, relief. Perhaps nowhere outside the United States is Biden's electoral triumph viewed with keener interest than in China and in the Asia-Pacific region. Consistent with his 2016 campaign message, President Trump significantly changed both the substance and tonality of U.S. relations with China, key U.S. allies such as Japan and Australia, and the region as a whole. To what degree and in what ways will U.S. policy toward China and the Asia-Pacific region change after Joe Biden takes the presidential oath of office on January 20, 2021? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming to the program Susan Thornton, a retired senior U.S. diplomat with almost 30 years of experience with the U.S. State Department. Susan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks, David.
In 2018, Ms. Thornton retired from the State Department after a diplomatic career focused primarily on East and Central Asia. As Acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, she managed critical U.S. diplomatic relationships amid escalating trade tensions with China and crises with North Korea. Among a number of other affiliations, she is currently a visiting lecturer in law at Yale Law School and senior fellow at the Paul Tsai China Center. Susan, let's start with the Trump administration's approach to China. 2 years out from your time in the administration, how do you assess the Trump administration's approach? What did the administration get right, and what do you think it got wrong?
Thanks, David. I really think that there are things that the Trump administration got right about China policy. First of all, the Trump administration correctly identified China's gaming of the international economic system as something that we needed to pay attention to and that needed a corrective. And it has done a good job of alerting all other trading partners and allies to this problem and focusing in on trying to find a way to correct it. I think the second thing that they have done right is that they have, as I say, focused in on the trade and economic piece of the U.S.-China relationship and tried to sort of put all of their diplomatic and political capital with China, if you will, into that basket to try to get movement on that front. And they've really focused almost exclusively, at least in the third year of the administration, on that effort. Of course, there are a lot of things that they didn't get right, and a lot of it has to do with the way in which they went about trying to achieve their goals. I would say that although identifying maybe the problem correctly, the process by which they went about trying to get that, achieve those goals was badly flawed. They didn't really have a strategy for getting there. And they didn't really have clear goals, and they didn't really stick to kind of what they set out to do, I think. And that was a real problem. Of course, they lost a lot of leverage and diplomatic and political capital with China by this kind of attitudinal dismissal or contempt that they really started to sow in this third year of the administration, but then ramped it up in the last year, certainly after the COVID-19 pandemic broke out. And this idea that, you know, sort of introducing the notion of the illegitimacy of the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, into the equation, I think probably went against whatever it was that they thought that they were trying to achieve. So I think, you know, what we need to do is be much more clear-eyed about what our goals are, what the strategy should be, what the tools we have are to employ to get to the goals, and then to try to carve out a kind of a balanced approach that's reasonable, that can get people on board with us. I mean, one of the big mistakes, of course, that the Trump administration made was to try to do everything alone. And China is a major player. It is a serious country to be dealt with, and it's not going to be very easy to do it just on our own. We've got to get reinforcements. You've got to build up pressure and leverage, and to do that, you need to have partners in the room with you.
Susan, the idea of reciprocity has seemingly been the central through line of this administration's approach to China. And indeed, as many, including me, have noted for many years, there has in fact been a massive degree of asymmetry in the relationship. That said, it seems like the Trump administration has embraced an approach in which the United States has sought to adopt some of China's worst practices as best practices to be emulated. For example, if China breaks WTO rules, we'll break them too. If China calls on its companies to serve the nation first and shareholders second, if at all, we'll do that too. If China views people-to-people exchanges with distrust and places limits on those exchanges, we will seek to do so as well. And the list goes on. Is reciprocity at all costs the right conceptual lens, in your view, for the U.S. to apply to this relationship? And is China even capable, given its regime type and doctrine, et cetera, of extending such reciprocity to the United States and the world?
The short answer, David, is no. But I think this point raises something that we need to dig into a little bit in U.S.-China relations, which is the difference in the two systems that we have. And it is true, and I will grant the Trump administration this, that the U.S. has made allowances over the years since the diplomatic opening to China in 1979. We have made allowances for China's different system. And we have done that because, mainly because, we wanted to remain the leader of the free world and stick to our values and our principles. And we understood that in certain areas, reciprocity was called for. And I could go into some of what those areas might be, but just for example, visa issuance and validity periods, exchanges of embassies and consulates in our two countries, et cetera, might be legitimate areas where you talk about reciprocity. It's very clear that you can achieve reciprocity. But in most areas, it's not going to be in the U.S.'s advantage to try to seek reciprocity with China, because we have sort of a higher authority to answer to, which is our democratic principles, our human rights principles, and our sort of free market and leader of the free world stature. So I think we've made a kind of tragic mistake now in pushing this idea of reciprocity in every area, even in areas where it's certainly undercuts our own legitimacy and is not to our advantage. I mean, China is not feeling the same pressure to change its behavior based on reciprocal practices that we are positing. And it just ends up in this kind of downward spiral where each side tries to, you know, hit lower than the other side. And this is really behavior unbecoming a great power like the United States, and it's unbecoming our traditional values and principles.
Drilling down a little further on the issue of trade and tariffs, which are another area which, as you rightly mentioned, have been seen as an area where there has been an unacceptable degree of asymmetry in our relationship, many have argued that the tariffs, the U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports, have actually hurt American workers and increased U.S. trade deficits with China and the world rather than doing the opposite. What's your take, just in brief, on the issue of the Trump tariffs?
Well, I mean, I personally wish that the U.S. would not take measures that are in violation of its own international commitments, which the tariffs, of course, are. But you can understand the impetus of people coming in who want to find a way to increase leverage in a negotiation on economics with China and to do things differently and shake things up and to really send a shot across the bow to China about, you know, these practices are not acceptable. They violate the commitments that you entered into upon WTO accession, and we're not going to put up with it anymore. So I think to some extent, some of these actions could be justified in that sense, but certainly many of the actions of the Trump administration on tariffs and other sanctions related to this have been sort of wildly fluctuating, non-strategic, and sort of inexplicable, actually, and switching 180 degrees from one day to the next. I mean, this is not the way to structure an effective negotiation. It's not the way to change China's behavior, which is what we should be trying to do. We should be trying to change its behavior on an ongoing basis to come more into line with the practices of other sort of free market, liberal, rules-based economic system so that we can absorb the Chinese economy into that system more effectively. And we really haven't changed any behavior on the part of China through this process, except for in a few peripheral areas that may or may not turn out to be enduring. So I think that is an unfortunate missed opportunity, but I do understand the impetus to try to do something different to get China's attention. It would have been better to, of course, do it together with others. That might have been difficult. It might have taken a long time. So the unilateral stick was the one that they went for. And I wish that we would have gotten more for it, obviously.
Looking ahead to the Biden administration, let me start with a basic question. In your view, how does Biden view China? And what distinction would you draw between Trump and Biden in their overarching views and assessments of China?
Well, I think Biden has a pretty realistic and balanced and clear-eyed view of China, but that may not end up mattering. And the reason I say that is that he is facing a situation that an incoming president of the United States would never wish to face, which is multiple catastrophes, a depletion of sort of international goodwill, a depletion of credibility on the likes of which we haven't seen recently. And I think he is going to be severely constrained in what he's going to be able to do with China. I think basically he's going to start off by trying to reestablish some credibility for the U.S. on the international stage by sort of rejoining some international institutions, trying to restart or re-engineer some of our relationships with our allies around the world, et cetera. And that'll be helpful to U.S.-China relations because basically what we need to do now is to sort of reestablish our own credibility, I think, before immediately going back to the well with the Chinese. But I think Biden wants to cooperate with China in areas of priority for him, and that would be first and foremost the COVID pandemic, trying to overcome that sort of health and public health crisis. Second, he wants to cooperate certainly with China on the issue of climate change, and cooperate here means basically introduce mutual pressure to do better on our commitments and to make fast progress while also maybe working together in some technology areas. But the cooperation isn't going to necessarily be all about friendliness. It's going to also be a lot of pressure and arm twisting. Certainly economic recovery is going to be a huge issue for Biden, and China plays into that in a very complicated way. And I think much as he may be looking to sort of start off on day one and make a list of goals that he wants to pursue with China and get back to it, it's going to be difficult to do that because he's got a lot of other burning issues on his plate that he has to take care of first.
Let me ask you one other question on kind of the China front specifically before turning to some questions about the Biden administration's approach to Asia more generally. And so I want to touch on the topic of Taiwan. The Trump administration seemingly has had a willingness in the wake of the passage in 2017 of the Taiwan Travel Act to kind of push the envelope and do things that previous U.S. administrations had not done, particularly in terms of high-level visits to the island. Do you see this trend continuing in a Biden administration? And more broadly, what is your take on the cross-strait relationship at this time? Do you see the current status quo as stable or precarious?
Well, I think the Trump administration has, from day one, even before they assumed office, shown that they well, that there is a mixture of appreciation for the gravity of the Taiwan issue for U.S. National security interests. And it's really never been treated, in my view, under the Trump administration as an issue unto itself, but more through the prism of either China or domestic politics. And I think that's quite dangerous. I don't think you will see the Biden administration do that to the same extent, because they do appreciate that this is the one area, and I firmly believe this, where the U.S. and China could end up in a major power conflict. The goal of the United States on the cross-strait issue should be to maintain the status quo, i.e., no independence, no unification, for as long as possible. And I think the Biden team does understand that. They also, though, do understand how difficult that is, given that the status quo is constantly changing and that various sides in this triangle, US, China, Taiwan, have an interest in moving the status quo as much as they possibly can get away with. So I think, you know, they have a quite sophisticated understanding of what needs to happen. The cross-strait relationship right now is very precarious, but I actually would argue that maybe the cross-strait relationship isn't as precarious as the U.S.-China relationship is right now. And I'm hopeful that, given that the current administration in Taiwan is, I think, quite pragmatic, that given that I think the Biden administration will be quite pragmatic on this issue, that things will stabilize to some extent in the near future. I don't think that Beijing wants to make this a major issue in the coming several years. There's a lot of other things on the plate that are higher priority, but they certainly are very serious about not taking losses or being seen to be losing their position in the cross-strait equation. So I think that's something that we need to keep a close eye on, as always, but more now than ever.
Let's look at U.S. policy toward Asia more generally. And let me start with just a basic question to kind of establish a baseline. With respect to U.S. policy toward Asia, would you say the change from the Obama administration to the Trump administration was truly substantive or more symbolic? And where do you think U.S. policy toward Asia as a region will go under the Biden administration?
I mean, Trump was really not very interested, actually, in U.S. policy toward Asia himself. You know, he was very focused on China and on the trade deficit with China. That was pretty much the extent of his personal focus, at least for the first, you know, pretty long period of time, in addition to the issue of North Korea, which sort of captured his imagination. But the rest of U.S.-Asia policy was not really something that Trump, I don't think, himself thought much about. His administration filled that space by coming up with this Indo-Pacific strategy, which actually in many senses is a continuity from the Obama administration's rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. But of course, the problem with the rebalance to the Asia-Pacific and the Indo-Pacific strategy, both were that, you know, they were just insufficiently resourced and got insufficient attention, so that the progress on the ground didn't really reflect that you were paying more attention or putting more priority or putting more resources of U.S. policy into the Asia Pacific. So I think that problem with the policy also continued in the Trump administration.
I want to talk a little bit more about the more specific issue of Asia-focused trade agreements. We just saw now the signing and launching of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. And of course, prior to that, we saw the launch without the United States as well of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I guess my question for you is, can the United States under President Biden still avail of any of this Pan-Asian trade infrastructure or architecture, I should say, or have we missed the boat on this at this point?
This is something that I think is really going to bear watching. I mean, the problem that Biden has, right, is that he's a liberal internationalist who believes in globalization, who believes in U.S. leadership of the international system, but he also is faced now with leading a country where the majority of people do not believe in globalization, are skeptical of free trade, and are certainly opposed probably to more trade agreements. And I think, you know, this is going to be very difficult for the U.S. to come back into being engaged in free trade agreements in Asia. I personally was there at the, you know, negotiation of TPP, negotiation of the U.S.-China bilateral investment treaty, which was really more about market access than it was about investment. And, you know, it just feels to me like it's going to be very difficult for us to get back to a place domestically where we can be contemplating signing or joining new trade agreements, which is quite potentially debilitating for the U.S., given that Asia is going to be the most dynamically growing part of the global economy for the coming decade, at least, probably. And actually, Europe is also moving to continue to conclude free trade agreements with Asia. So we risk really being kind of isolated and left out. And I think that is something that the Biden team is probably worried about. But, you know, domestic politics are going to come into play in a big way here. And it's going to be very difficult to overcome that.
Just one comment on that. One thing I found interesting, it was about a year or a year and a half ago, was that it was either Pew or Gallup did a poll on U.S. sentiment toward trade and found that there had been a basically complete reversal of the respective positions of the two major parties in the United States on trade, with about 75% of Democrats regarding themselves as pro-trade and against the Trump tariffs, and about 75% of Republicans as being, just as you rightly noted, against globalization and for the tariffs. And so we actually have a scenario now where the Democratic Party, the party that President-elect Biden leads, is, according to U.S. Public opinion data, the pro-trade party. And I wonder, notwithstanding the very good points you make about the political constraints in this country on any president that would like to engage in, quote, free trade agreements, that maybe Biden has a bit more of a basis to do that politically than a Republican president would, simply because of those sentiments having shifted the way they have. But let me ask just two other questions, Susan. One is, what is your assessment as to the state of the U.S. alliances in East Asia? Did the 4 years of the Trump administration do any lasting damage to these alliances, as many former senior U.S. officials have argued? Or are the alliances in decent shape? And on a related note, how will the Biden approach to these alliances differ from that of President Trump? For example, will there be any chance of a greater level of coordination and unity in terms of the United States working with allies and key trading partners as it deals with China? One of the points, of course, that you made very rightly earlier is that the United States has sought to do so much relative to China on its own. Do you think that might change as we go forward?
Yeah, this is a really good question. And it, of course, depends on which countries we're talking about as comes to the alliances. But in general, I believe that most of our close partners and allies in Asia don't want the U.S. to be starry-eyed or naive about the challenges that China poses in the region. So on that score, the Trump administration's very muscular kind of approach to China, to some extent, was somewhat welcomed in many places. But on the other hand, of course, this sort of very kind of bullying posture extended to some of our close allies, which they did not appreciate. And I think one of the things we have to recognize as Americans about what's happened in the last 4 years is that two things. One, we have introduced a new reticence into much of the world about America's commitment and America's staying power as the leader of sort of the international system. And two, and that's particularly true, I think, in the Asia Pacific region, where there were already questions being raised about this, hence the rebalance to the Asia Pacific, the pivot, all of this, you know, Indo-Pacific strategy. That's all about reassuring people that we're going to be there and that we're going to stay. The reason we have to do that is because there are questions being raised about that. But the second problem that we're going to face is that many countries over the past 4 years of U.S. kind of isolationist and unilateralist actions have kind of taken on new agency and have kind of moved on or figured out how to work around us or with other partners or on their own, et cetera. And so they may be less needy or less prone to listening to our unsolicited advice, and they will be more reticent about, I think, joining with us to do things in the future, especially given, and many people have commented on this, but it's certainly been noticed in Asia, the huge numbers of people still supporting President Trump and his kind of isolationist, unilateralist turn. They wonder, you know, what's going to happen in 4 years after a President Biden administration. And so just a lot of questions have now been introduced. And I think it is going to make it even harder for Biden to sort of restore American leadership and to restore our close relationships with our partners in Asia.
On a related note, Susan, let me just ask you this last question. And it's about America's image in Asia and the world. What do you make of the fact that, according to the Pew Research Center, Xi Jinping is viewed more favorably among America's closest allies than Donald Trump? What does that mean for our country? And with Biden becoming president, do we just bounce back to those higher favorables, or has lasting damage been done to America's international image and reputation that will outlive damage that will outlive the Trump presidency?
Let me just take this opportunity, David, to say that I actually don't put a lot of stock in a lot of polling that I see, and people misuse polls more than they use them properly. So I tend to, I mean, we have to have a measure somehow of something, I suppose, but, you know, the polls in the recent U.S. election weren't so accurate really either. So I think we have to treat polling with caution. But the problem really for us now is that, you know, U.S. credibility on the world stage is diminished. And I think the Chinese approach in this period where the U.S. has been in a unilateral mode has been to try to fill the void of places where the U.S. has withdrawn. They haven't actually had as much success at that as one might think they could have had. And I think that is something that should give us a little bit of pause and maybe is a cause for a certain amount of more optimism about, you know, how this is going to evolve going forward between the U.S. and China. I personally, and I think you know this, David, having known me, believe that the estimates of China's sort of march on the world have been sort of vastly exaggerated in some cases for our own domestic political purposes. I think there are a lot of issues that China has itself to grapple with, and I think there are a lot of opportunities for the U.S. to come back. But I'll tell you one thing that was maybe the most sobering moment for me of the last 2 years is when a high-ranking official in Asia, after a particularly bruising encounter with the Trump administration, you know, said to me, "Well, you know, we used to think that America was a generous country, but now our people are coming to realize that maybe that wasn't the case." And I think that's the level of disappointment that you're facing here. It's going to be hard to come back from that, because actually the American electorate doesn't seem to be feeling very generous about the rest of the world right now. And I personally think this has a lot more to do with our own insecurities about our place in the world, the lack of a convincing vision or articulated purpose for American power in the world and how it connects back to average citizens. So I really would think that one of the main things the Biden administration could do that would help us all for the long-term future is to connect people better with what's going on in the world and how it affects them and why it's important that we have partners and allies in the world, how it helps them, that it's not a giveaway, that it's not simply, you know, America being duped by the rest of the world. We have to show people how the world really works and not be seduced by our own sort of malign narratives about everything.
Well, Susan, I think that's really well said. And I have to say, I couldn't agree more with that assessment and also that aspiration. Before we close the show, Susan, I'd like to thank you once again for joining us and sharing your insights. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. It was great to be with you.
And remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you so much for listening.